From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. Welcome to the program. How can we reconcile belief in a loving God with the suffering of innocent human beings and earthly creatures in the natural world? This question, as old as the Old Testament's Book of Job, has been mainly grappled with over the centuries by learned theologians and philosophers. But in a new groundbreaking work, My Tsunami Journey, The Quest for God in a Broken World, author Mark Dowd is sent on a journey across thousands of miles to speak to Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, and Christians like himself following the 2004 colossal tsunami waves that killed more than 230,000 people. In the wake of such carnage, why do some people lose their faith while others emerge with it intact and straightened? Are these events in the natural world really linked to divine justice as, quote, punishment for sin? And if not, what are the best possible explanations for why an intelligent and caring deity would fashion a world in which babies can die of leukemia and the elderly fall victim to deadly viruses such as COVID-19? Well, this book will offer profound food for thought for troubled believers and curious agnostics alike. It's a delight to have the author on today's program, and Mark Dowd comes to us from outside of London, England. Mark Dowd, welcome to Journey's Fire.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I love your background. I mean, a former Dominican friar turned BBC journalist. Can you share a little bit about that journey? Because it's that journey and that combination that has really served you well in not only this book, but other projects you've done.
Yeah, you know, I went to university at the age of 18 as a what we call a cradle Catholic. I went to a Catholic school. I had a Catholic family. I naively went to university thinking that everyone in the world was a believer and probably just like me. And then about the age of 18, 19, I find myself in one of those wretched student parties drinking cheap white wine from plastic cups. And somebody saying, how can you believe in God when babies die of leukemia? And I said, well, I was always told it was an inscrutable mystery. And somebody said, you're going to have to do a lot better than that. And then I started looking around and thinking, who are the clever people who have faith? Who are the brain boxers? And somebody said, you either have to hunt out the Jesuits or the Dominicans because these guys have got immense IQs. And so I went to Oxford. I started talking to a number of the friars there, and I thought, gosh, these guys are really smart. I can see a place for me amongst them, maybe working in university as a chaplain or something like that. And so I joined the merry band of friars. I lasted 2 years before I realized that basically I wasn't cut out for religious life. I'm not that kind of solitary sort of person who can just eschew human intimacy and connection. And I didn't want to be one of these dreadful hypocrites who practiced one thing and said another, you know?
Sure.
And so I think God, in God's amazing way, followed me through a period of going into journalism. And I got involved for many years doing what we call current affairs projects here. American elections, might be of interest to your listeners. Northern Ireland, the troubles there, politics. And then I got this amazing break. I came back from a sabbatical year, and the head of Channel 4 outside the BBC called me in for a chat and said, we have nobody who presents religious programs for us, and you trained to be a priest. Why don't you do this for us? And so that marked the beginning of like 15 years of basically talking about God on television.
Isn't it fascinating how that always works out? God has a plan, but we don't see it in the beginning.
It's extraordinary how, you know, ironically, I said to my former prior, my former boss when I was Dominican, I sent him a copy of this latest book and said, Timothy, I hope you can see the hallmarks and the legacy of my time with you in the order. And I said rather teasingly, by the way, This program I made about the tsunami, Where Was God, it got more than 1 million viewers. I bet you don't get that many when you preach in a church.
Well, that is so true. And actually, you probably have a much wider audience now that you're really speaking to, which I think is wonderful. I love the subtitle of this book, The Quest for God in a Broken World, because not only are we going to deal specifically what you've learned about the tsunami that happened, which was so tragic, but these days, you know, here in the United States, we are probably more divided than we ever have been in the history of this country. Now we have Roe v. Wade and a verdict coming down on that, I believe, in June sometime, as well as just other things that are splitting this country apart. And I think a lot of people, in their own way, be it Christian or non-Christian, are asking that question, where is God in all of this?
Yeah, and I think I would draw a distinction between what you call moral evil and natural evil in all of these brokennesses that you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, somebody said to me the other day, where is God in the Ukraine war? And I quite stoutly and defiantly said, well, you know, God gave the likes of Putin choice and free will and ethics. Now, let's assume that God doesn't like what Putin is doing and stops him. Where on that spectrum of human freedom and autonomy does God intervene and not intervene? Mm-hmm. Is there some sort of calculator that God has that says, do you know, I'll just let these people have their freedom until we get to 10,000 lives, and that's actually quite bad, so I think I'll intervene.
Yeah.
I mean, God would have to intervene all the time or not at all. And if God intervenes all the time in our choices, we have become robots and we are denied the status of being children of God. It must be like, and all parents listening to this program must identify with this, every time you have to stand aside and watch your child choose unwisely and know that they will hopefully learn from the consequences of their actions, you are extending a painful act of love to them, you know?
Mm-hmm. True, so true.
And so this is where the focus of my book is a much trickier one, I think, for believers, because, you know, the free will defense that humans abuse their freedom does get God off the hook, if you like, quite a lot of times. But when you come to death and disease and hurricanes and tsunamis and COVID, it's like, you know, couldn't you do better, God? I mean, why have you made a world with all of these booby traps? And I think that is basically the thing that haunted me at the beginning of this journey and basically motivated the book.
Well, you make some great points. So I will reword a little bit the question, and that is, why doesn't God prevent natural disasters? Because we're having, in this country, we're having so many of them, but I know we are worldwide as well.
Well, of course, we have to distinguish between whether man actually has some role in some of these natural disasters. I mean, I know the denial of climate change and climate science is quite a big thing in the USA. It has been in the UK amongst the minority. But obviously, if we are responsible for some of these environmental catastrophes because of the way that we've changed,
yeah,
the gift of creation and the gift of nature, is that a natural thing or is that a man-induced thing? So that's one point. But secondly, I think there is a larger issue here, which takes us to the book of Job. And the more I read and reread that book, the more I realized how extraordinarily profound it is as a piece of writing, and how all of these questions, which we categorize as modern and existential and new to the post-18th, 19th century, actually have been around in the human condition for ages, which is, you know, I'm a virtuous guy. Why have you done this to me? You know?
Yeah.
Of course, what that book does brilliantly is two things. First of all, it says there's no neat equation between being virtuous and steering clear of pain and suffering in this world. And actually, Islam, a formidable world religion, has a very interesting take on this, because in the Quran, there's a message from Allah that says, just because you're virtuous does not mean you will not be tested. Tests and of all of these things come to the virtuous and the non-virtuous alike. But secondly, I think there's a profound point, which is a lot of the things that we categorize as negative in a systemic natural world actually have extraordinarily powerful roles to play. It's just that sometimes the human beings are at the rough cutting edge of them. So one of the revelations in this book, which I had never thought about, was that tectonic plates have an immensely positive role to play in the planet. And it's like, what? I mean, if they weren't there, there wouldn't be earthquakes and tsunamis and everybody would survive them. So how can you say they're good? And then you listen to scientists saying they force land above water necessary for human life. Mm-hmm. They replenish the crust of the earth with iron and other mineral ores necessary for agriculture. Earthquakes themselves actually responsible for the atmospheric distribution of oxygen on this planet, which is just the perfect level required for human life. It's about 20% of the atmosphere. If it was 15, it would be too little. If it was 23, 24%, it would be too much. There is something which is called the anthropic principle, which is basically if you look at all the different things like the forces of gravity, the composition of the atmosphere, the chances of all of this coming together in the perfect way necessary for human intelligent life are like one in a zillion. Now, you either react to that with, well, it's just an amazing coincidence, or you look at your scripture and you think, you know, there's a story here which actually requests us to respond in a spiritual as well as a materialistic way. And I think there is a hidden purpose in the material world, and that's very much what's at the core of this book.
You know, I was alarmed to read just yesterday that the state of California said their two largest reservoirs are almost dry, and it's not even summer yet. So we're beginning to see things like that, let alone species becoming extinct and such. You know, all natural disasters, and I agree with you. I think humans have played such a role in this. You asked a lot of questions from a lot of people. In your quest, were there any insights from atheists?
Yeah, you know what's really fascinating about this? One of the first people I interviewed was the famous, you won't like the description, high priest of atheism, Richard Dawkins,
yeah.
The author of the Selfish Gene, and of course the huge success, The God Delusion. And Richard Dawkins had really annoyed me after the tsunami in 2004 because he wrote to a national newspaper in this very sarcastic letter. He said, oh, 125,000 people already dead. I wonder whether that creator God of yours is listening to you. Maybe it's time for you to give up believing he's even there. And I went to interview him, and I said, do people like you get a lot of pleasure out of the discomfort of people like me when these things happen? And there was this schadenfreude. It was almost, oh, no. but what he did say, Richard, which is really interesting, in the latter part of the interview, I said, it's 10 seconds before you die. You don't know the answer to Big Bang and why there's anything in this world rather than nothing at all. Mm-hmm. Even with all of your great scientific powers, there's still a huge, huge question there as to why this material world has an existence. Wouldn't you allow yourself just a little wobble, a little doubt before you die? And then he said, the kind of God I could believe in, that almost made me fall off my seat, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
The kind of God I could believe in is the kind of God who could set up the laws of physics, the laws of nature and science, in a way that grounded everything that we observe in an extraordinary way. But that kind of God wouldn't be remotely interested in answering the odd prayer. And what he'd done in that answer is, first of all, go a lot further than I know he'd ever done before. But secondly, he'd pitted the personal biblical God against the God of science and wonder, and they're the same God.
Yeah.
They're not. It was a schizophrenic. It's as almost he was simply saying, I can't believe in a God who answers prayer. He had a notion of prayer which is purely infantile and petitionary. Please give me this. Please give me that. Please let me win the lottery. It was the Bruce Almighty kind of God, you know?
Yes.
The God who just to send the thunderbolt down and answers all of our petitions. You know, if our notion of prayer is us being quiet and silence and just allowing ourselves to become united with something that's deeper beyond ourselves, that isn't petitionary at all, but it is about moving the space of your existence from the purely biological to a different sphere, and that is what deep prayer is all about. So maybe one day Richard Dawkins and I will be praying together in church. Who knows?
Who knows? Who knows? You know, I live in Indianapolis, Indiana, and just south of us is the state of Kentucky, and it wasn't that long ago when tornadoes poured through that state and others. Disastrous results. Lives were lost. Property was lost. It was very unusual, especially for Kentucky, to experience that. So as a person of faith myself, how can faith survive when natural disasters hit, but also wars and famine and poverty and other man-made fiascos?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing we have to do is clear up the kind of mischievous opportunism of those people, like in the book of Job. You remember Job's comforters who go around all the time saying to Job, oh, well, you know, you must have done something wrong because here you are covered in sores and disease. And, you know, in other words, this idea that all of these things happen as a divine punishment for sin, that really is nonsense. In the film that we made, there was an extraordinary scene where the Westboro Baptist Church in Kansas had put out a press release after the tsunami saying, praise the Lord, there are 25,000 Swedes who've died. Their logic was Sweden had a very liberal take on homosexuality and LGBT rights. Therefore, God had disproportionately taken many, many more Swedes in the tsunami as a punishment for this. I mean, this, you know, the opportunism that people have when these things go wrong absolutely has to be countered. Secondly, we have to divest ourselves of these simplistic explanations. God uses these things to make us better because he gives us a chance to be virtuous and to show how generous we are. Well, I can't believe in a tyrant who instrumentally uses a tornado so that people will die and doctors and nurses can show how marvelous they are, because I'd rather the tornado didn't happen in the first place. And thirdly, the favorite one, of course, for Christians, oh, it's all Adam and Eve's fault. I mean, it was all perfect, and there was no death, and there was none of these horrors until rebellion occurred in the garden, and it all went wrong. And the problem is that all of these things we're talking about, the pain, death, and suffering at the heart of this physical world, predate human existence.
Yeah.
So it didn't suddenly appear after this fall. I mean, the book of Genesis is full of truth with a big T and amazing insights, but they are not the literal truths popping off that page. They require immense nuance, wisdom, and interpretation. But the fact of the matter is, you and I wouldn't be here today having this conversation were it not for the fact that we have evolved after hundreds of thousands of years of evolution in which many, many species have been eliminated. And there's been a lot of wastage, if you like, in creation. But yet, here we are at the kind of apex of it, which is quite extraordinary.
You know, Marcus, sometimes angers me when I hear examples of, for example, that church in Kansas and so many other Christians who share things that I can't even believe they're sharing. One of my favorite teachers, and he's been on this show several times, Father Richard Rohr, who's a Catholic monk, Franciscan. You know, I've learned a lot from him about just embracing the mystery of it all also. And he would even say that there's a lot in the Christian faith that have stopped following Jesus. They worship Jesus. They've stopped following him in some of the examples that he's set. But also, there's that mystery of faith that comes in. And I know I've had to face that a lot as a hospice chaplain when patients have died and families come to me and say, why? Why did God take my husband, my child, my grandfather? And that's why I've really appreciated your insights I've gleaned from this book, My Tsunami Journey, and also what you're sharing today on this broadcast. People do have these questions, and we are in a broken world, and there's a lot of people who will so easily give up on God because of that.
Will. And the thing is that it's so hard in those moments of loss, where people are traumatized, where their wounds are exposed, you can't intellectualize and come up with these grand explanations, which in the calmer moments of thought, when you're not tormented by these things, actually make a lot of sense. So for instance, you know, if you're close to a tectonic plate, when it kind of goes, you can't say to people who've lost huge numbers of their family, oh, well, you know, it's part of this amazing process where the crust is renewed and future generations will benefit from an agricultural point of view. I mean, it's like, no, I've just lost 5 of my children, and how can you even say that? And, you know, often what is good for the system, the whole, is often painful at the cutting edges. One of the examples in the book is the good old humble mosquito. On a trip to Central America I made, I remember being in the fields of El Salvador with a wonderful agricultural laborer, and I said, you know, why has God made mosquitoes? What is the purpose of these horrible, annoying little things that just give you malaria? And this man, he was no learned scholar, put his tools down and said to me, you ignorant man. And I said, what? He said, a tiny proportion of mosquitoes transmit malaria. They are massively important in the food chain. They are arch pollinators. They fulfill this extraordinary role in keeping the whole of the food chain going amongst the insect world. And here you are, just looking at it from your small, human, narrow point of view. And I thought, gosh, I've been put in my place. I better go and say a prayer to Oscar Romero.
What surprised you the most, Mark, when you interviewed survivors of the tsunami in Southeast Asia?
Their grace and resignation. There were people we met who were broken, but they were broken in a way that they were angry with God and they hadn't given up on God. I think there's a big difference. I think anger is the continued existence of a relationship. We see it in the Psalms. You know, why do you hide your face from me? You know, where are you? Why have you done this to me? I'm a virtuous person and yet the wicked prosper. But the psalmist isn't saying, I don't believe you're there. The psalmist is saying, I'm stopping writing because I've given up on you. It's, I'm hurting and I don't understand. Please bring yourself back into my life. It's a bit like a marriage going wrong sometimes. You know, we sometimes have that kind of situation, don't we, where when couples are rowing and arguing, at least they have the passion and desire for the thing to continue. It's when you get the slow fade of apathy and indifference and lack of interest that death kicks in a relationship. And, you know, what I found with a lot of the people, there's a woman in India who utterly, totally bamboozled me. She sat there smiling with a picture of the 4-year-old son who'd been killed in the tsunami. He had this beautiful face with big brown eyes. His name was Dinesh. And I said, Ramai, why are you smiling? I thought you'd be utterly distraught. And she said, because I don't believe that my son has died. Hindus believe that everything that lives has spirit and is indestructible. And in Dinesh, there was a divine spark of life when I had him with me here. And all I can say is God has gone to God. And she smiled and she said, I see him every day. In the smiles of other children on the streets, in the gestures of other people, the way that they walk and move. And no, she said, I refuse to be saddened by this. Of course I would love to have him here, but I believe he is there with God, taken up and reincarnated, and maybe one day we will be united together in what Hindus call Brahman, you know, universal spirit. And you walk away from an interview like that and you think, what right have I got to moan about my aches and pains and occasional melancholy when that woman is embracing life with such vigor, you know?
You know, the tsunami happened in Thailand back in 2004, and I think we forget, with everything else that has happened since then, that in that tsunami over 230,000 people died. The degree of that tragedy. And so, Mark, beyond religion, are there cultural differences in how people in Asia contend with natural disasters as opposed to those of us in the West?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, in Sri Lanka and Thailand, you have a very strong Buddhist culture. And, of course, Buddhists have a very interesting take on the concept of God's existence. There are some Buddhists who deny completely the purpose of using the word like God and say that I just don't believe in a deity or a creator.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha himself, I think, was much more subtle. I think many Buddhist scholars would say that the Buddha left the door open. He said, look, you cannot prove nor disprove the existence of a God, but why would you want to spend the whole of your life chasing your tail and worrying about that? There's this lovely story the Buddha told. If you walk down the street and suddenly an arrow comes from nowhere and hits you in the chest and you begin to bleed to death, you don't spend the next 30 minutes saying, who made the arrow? Where did it come from?
True.
You get to the hospital and you fix the wound.
Yeah.
And the Buddha's notion of combating dukkha, suffering as it's known, is suffering is a fact of life. Just help to heal it amongst your human beings and leave these questions about God and the ultimate meaning of the world for another time. I think there's some practical moral sense in that. The problem is, when you're a Catholic like I am, belief in God is in your DNA. It's my parents. It's my school. It's all the people I've known and loved. And you can't just click a delete button and say, I choose not to believe anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as simple as that. It's letting go of perhaps practically everything that has made you, you know. And of course, one thing that we do have as Christians, which is not really common to the Hindu and the Buddhist notion of the world, even though Jesus is massively respected, of course, as a teacher and a ethicist, we have this extraordinary climax to the life of God on earth. If our big problem is, how could you have made a world with all this suffering and meaninglessness and pointlessness? What God does in those last few days is enter into that dark space. Can you imagine? I think there's one thing worse than suffering, and that's purposelessness.
Mm-hmm.
That's nihilism. It's the idea that there is no ultimate grounding or meaning to anything at all, and that everything is just arbitrary. And the moment on the cross where Jesus has been abandoned by everybody save his mother and John there and one or two others, everybody else has fled, everyone's mocking him. God, we ask, where is God all the time when these things are going on? Does God send his angels? Does God intervene at that moment? No. God embraces that moment and goes through it and basically says, you know, this is not the end. That empty tomb is the end of the book, not the cross itself. And those 3 days of crucifixion and resurrection are an extraordinary answer, I think, an invitation. They're not an answer in a perfectly intellectual way. It's basically saying to us, don't tell me about suffering and meaninglessness and horror, because I've been through the most horrible, torturous, painful death that one can imagine and been abandoned by everybody. But I'm telling you, that is not the end. And I think that as Christians gives us quite a lot to hold on to in the darkest moments, you know?
Yes, yes. Where does karma and the belief in karma play into this?
Well, that's quite shocking because, you know, in Thailand, I was there talking to this lovely woman called Walapa. She'd lost her 5 and 9-year-old daughters. And she was just sitting there in tears, shaking her head. And I said, well, you know, you're a Buddhist. What does the Buddha teach about why this has happened and how you must deal with it? And she said, I believe in karma, and I think this happened to my children because they did something bad in a previous life.
Hmm.
And I said, what? She said, yes, well, that's the only explanation I have, that they did some terrible things in a previous life, and when their spirits were born into my children, they somehow had to pay the price for this negative legacy that they inherited. The first thing I thought of was, what happens to any child who inherits the soul of Pol Pot or Hitler?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a very fair start in life, is it?
Yeah.
With such a negative bank balance, as it were, which made me have very, very doubtful views about reincarnation. But I have to say, what it did also teach me was that human beings are really bad at dealing with a notion of arbitrariness and randomness, that we can just simply have the wrong genes, be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And this isn't because of karma. It's not because of divine punishment. It's not because of Adam and Eve. And it's not because God is somehow, you know, instrumentally using suffering to make us better. It's a fact of life that in a material world, there are positives and negatives which we belong to each other, and that's the world we're born into. And it's a world of rainbows and sunsets and amazing inspiration, and that's also a world that's shared with disease and suffering. But if you could put all of these positives and negatives into some amazing calculator and press the button, are there many of us that would simply say the world is a terrible, horrible place and I'd rather we didn't have it? Yeah. I think most of us would embrace it, yeah, despite all of its difficulties. And those are often people who are very poor, who actually, when we look at them, we're told endlessly that the happiest, most content people in the world are people who often have very, very little. So I don't buy this idea that God is some treacherous monster who's created this booby-trap-filled playground full of monsters and horrors. It's a largely good, amazing world, which has... It's like in a beautiful shirt that you have, that you keep finding the occasional crease there and you can't iron it out and get rid of it. But, I mean, I take a broadly positive view of nature and the world and wonder, and I refuse to be pessimistic and say that God has come up with a dud and a flawed model.
Mm-hmm.
God has, and God in Jesus says to us, actually, even where it does go wrong, I tell you, there's a way through this.
You know, what you shared about people who often have little seem to be the most grateful for what they have was played out for me in the 5 trips I've made to Haiti in working with Haitian people, mostly humanitarian type work. And I always came back to the States being very humbled by their faith and by their joy, given that compared to them, I'm an incredibly, incredibly wealthy person from what they have. Because of differences of beliefs, we also react differently to things. And I'm curious, Mark, do the people of Southeast Asia, do they have a better relationship with death than those of us in the West?
Yeah, that brings to mind the haunting words of this Buddhist monk. His temple had been turned into a temporary morgue, mortuary. He said that the smell of rotting bodies for several weeks just made him sick. He couldn't meditate or do yoga or contemplate at all because of the sheer distraction. And then he took me around the temple and showed me all these photos of these unclaimed, unidentified bodies, and there were hundreds of them. It was like a kind of gallery to death, you know. And I came out and said, gosh, you know, that's quite a chilling, arresting experience. And he stood there smiling and said, but why? He said, death is your friend. And I said, my friend?
Hmm.
He said, yes, because death promises to release you from the eternal business of birth and rebirth. And, you know, one day you will get what the Hindus call moksha, which is deliverance from being reborn, and you will be eternally united with all that is, God, spirit, whatever you want to call it. He said, death is a release. You must look forward to your death. It's most wonderful. And I said, yeah, I think I'll try and get around to thinking a bit more about that. But I think, you know, in a world... In India and Indonesia, where there is much less fortification in terms of houses and buildings and medicine and so on, I think death and disease is just such a radically daily and weekly occurrence in people's lives that it's embraced with a sort of, you know, not a resignation in the sense of fatalism, but it's just part of the furniture. Whereas in the West, you know, the slightest hint that somebody might possibly be suffering from cancer, and the whole world stops, and the whole of their entourage is informed about it, and we fret endlessly for weeks and weeks and weeks waiting for tests. And, you know, it's a different world out there. The rector of this Catholic shrine that we visited in Velankani in Tamil Nadu on the Indian coast, I sat there with him and I said, did your local people after the tsunami, did they say, where was God? How could God do this to us? And he smiled at me rather patronizingly. He said, no, Mark. He said, no, only Western journalists like you ask this question.
How was your faith, Mark, affected by writing this book?
Well, first of all, I really, really was grateful to my father's intervention on the night of that tsunami,
mm-hmm.
When we saw the first TV images. This man who never missed church, he was a very devout believer, looked white in the face and turned to me and said, why didn't God stop that? And I blurted out some fairly unconvincing answer about how the laws of nature have to be predictable and behave according to their own nature. And he just looked at me with this, you know, I'm not convinced sort of look. And it was that set us off on this journey, because it was that question of his that got the TV authorities to commission this journey. I have to say that when my dad asked that question, it was though it hit some like George Orwell Room 101 nerve in my theological brain, because I knew that was the real weak bit. Mm. That was the real point where I was just floundering for anything like a remotely convincing answer.
Yeah.
And so my faith underwent a series of extraordinary enrichings, really. First of all, by the faith, I called it faith by proxy. I still think I have a very weak faith. I'm terrible at prayer. I'm really, really like one of those apostles who would run off in cowardice, probably in the Garden of Gethsemane, rather than stick around and be counted. But I found so much endurance and fortification, really, from the faith of others. I call it faith by proxy.
Uh-huh.
I don't have this faith, but I'm amazed at you. I'm amazed at your witness. I'm amazed at the power of your belief. And secondly, I think there was a realization on this trip that you don't answer the problem about God and evil by clever arguments and forms of words, but you answer it in the way that you are with others in the world. The people who moved me the most weren't people with clever theological arguments. They were people who were surrounded by hundreds of admiring poor people, mm-hmm. saying, this man is a saint. He's there for us every morning, and he stays with us all day, and he helps us to find food, and he prays with us, and he's like a Christ in our midst, and he's a man who God has sent to help us. And you sit there with tears coming down your eyes, and you think, that life is an answer to suffering. It's not a clever book or a clever academic article. It's just an existential way of being in the world. I think what Martin Heidegger, the philosopher, called Dasein, being in the world, the sense of just having physical body but acting out on a daily way, this is the life of saintliness, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no coincidence that in the climax of the book, we don't resolve intellectually, ultimately, the question of Job. You know, Job is there demanding that God give him a final answer in the last chapter or two. And all God says is, where were you when I created all this?
Yeah.
So you're not going to get an answer.
Yeah.
But God is faithful because God is there. At the end, God is there at the end of the story, just as the way that God is there in the empty tomb at the end of it all. And secondly, it's this notion of saints, even if they're small in number and very exceptional, it only takes one amazing, brilliant life to inspire you.
Mm-hmm.
If you can hang on to that life and try and follow it, that is the way forward. If tens of thousands of people behave badly and immorally, then so be it. But, you know, God in an Oscar Romero, in the life of a Mandela and a Gandhi, and the saints that we know who walk the face of the earth, these are the beacons, the torches, who dance and live and die before us, who have to keep us going through the difficulties. And I think that's where my faith was enriched, because I met not just saints in terms of the famous people who people invoke, but every one saint that we know who has recognized by the church, there are thousands who never get recognition. Saintliness is far more common than I think we ever give it credit for.
So true. So true. You know, I don't know where this quote came from, World War I, World War II, maybe something else, but that quote I'm thinking of now is, there are no atheists in foxholes. So is spirituality integral to the human race, especially after natural disasters like the tsunami?
Yes, it has. I think it is natural because, you know, we had a book launch here in the UK for this book just a couple of weeks ago, and the point I made when I was doing a little reading and sharing a few thoughts with people was that, you know, I was very mindful of the fact that many of the people who were my friends who come along are not churchgoers. They don't really have a place for God in their world, but they came out of curiosity about this book and out of loyalty to me, really, as a friend. But what I wanted to say to them was, look, the talk of the death of God is rapidly going out of fashion, and it's much exaggerated, because the fact of the matter is that faith and spirituality is in a very, very healthy state in huge numbers of parts of the world, in Asia, in Africa, in South America. The USA is a much more vibrantly religious culture than Western Europe. Mm-hmm. But there's this tendency when you're here in Western Europe and church attendance declines, and people basically think that their religion is their local soccer or baseball team rather than the creator God. You tend to think that somehow this thing is fading and going out of existence, but it's not. 90 to 95% of this planet have a vibrant belief in a spiritual dimension, and we have been and always will be spiritual creatures. I think that's undeniable.
What made you decide to focus on this disaster 20 years or more later?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'd already published a book as an autobiography, and it had been very well received and very popular. And in fact, it was an American publisher based in Oregon, mm-hmm. who had asked me to review one of the books that they commissioned. And in a conversation with them, they said, Mark, by the way, we loved your first book. Have you ever thought about writing another one? And I scratched my head and I said, well, you know, there's this film we made that was broadcast in 2005. It's called Tsunami, Where Was God? I know it's 15 years on, but I've often thought it will be an extraordinary story of journey and discovery, and it does deal with the most difficult obstacle to faith that exists. So they said, oh, well, send us a proposal. So I set out 7 or 8 chapters of how the book would look, and they said, we normally take 8 to 9 weeks to think about this and get back to you, so please just bear with us. And within 2 weeks, they came back and said, we raised it at our editorial meeting last week. It's a yes. but you know what's interesting, Richard, is that the first 5 chapters of this 6-chapter book is pretty faithful to what's in that film and the story. Mm. The 6th chapter was an attempt to say, I've had 15 more years to think about all this. Where do I go with it now? What do I think about it now? And are there new things that I've reflected on? Because if you're an analytical and slightly restless character like me, you never stop thinking about these things. You don't somehow put these things in a drawer and it's all done and dusted and it's all sorted. And what it did really allow me to do was almost to meditate on one of my heroes in the Gospels, which is Thomas. I begin the 6th chapter by saying, you know, I was born on the 21st of December, which was, when I was a child, the feast day of St. Thomas. How appropriate that someone with so many doubts like me should share the feast day of Thomas. And then the church stole him and put him on the 3rd of July. Leaving me with this dreadful word, feria, which meant any old boring sort of day in Advent. but then I go back to Thomas, and I explore why his doubts are absolutely so integral to faith. And then I basically take it on to really an examination of incarnation, because I used to think the resurrection was the really big thing. And that was the kind of quotes answer to everything.
Yeah.
But if you're worried about why a material world is so ambiguous, which is full of beauty but suffering, full of transcendence but also pain, then the fact that God enters this world not as a mighty, powerful force, but as a vulnerable child that almost got crushed by King Herod, and whose mission on earth comes to a disastrous failing end after 33 years.
Mm-hmm.
If that is God's way of saying, I will be with you through all this, that's an extraordinary thing. And I think incarnation, the fact that God in Christ, the Logos, the divine word, is both uniquely material and spiritual, like two sides of a coin that are inseparable. I think that... in one of St. Paul's letters, we're told that Christ is the firstborn of all creation. We tend to think, because we're so historically and time-ridden, that the Trinity really is about God the Father being there, and then 2,000 years ago, suddenly the second person of the Trinity comes from nowhere into existence. But of course, the Trinity transcends time, and so the Christ figure who is outside and before time is also the figure that takes on flesh and dies and transforms the world. And God as love is the curse of the Christian vocation, because when you have to explain natural disasters and suffering, if your conception of God is ultimately love, not power, not mystery, not unknowingness, as the Muslims in Indonesia said to me, you can't put God in the dot because God is unknowable and beyond reproach. But actually I said, well, I can put God in the dot because God tells us he's love. And how has he made a world in which all these thousands of people have died? That's a curse for us, but the blessing, of course, is the love shown in his son through the life and death and resurrection of that second person of the Trinity. And I think that, in a sense, is why I wanted to write the book, because I think I've had the chance to contemplate and ponder more on that mystery. And also in the last page or two, in a moment of self-reproach, Richard, I said, it's time for this Western analytical brainy male to stop thinking as much and begin to pray a little bit more.
I love that. That is very sound advice for sure. I'm also curious personally, but I think my listeners would also want to know, the two-hour special, the documentary you created years ago called Tsunami, Where Was God? And it won a lot of different awards. Can that still be seen somehow online?
Yeah, it's on YouTube. I think if we had a slightly more a richer publisher, we'd have made zillions of copies of this film and had it sort of sold at the same time as the book. But yeah, anyone listening to this who wants to, having read the book, see what these people are like in 3D form and to meet some of these characters on screen, all you have to do is go on YouTube and you type in Tsunami, Where Was God? You'll find it there in three parts. And it was actually uploaded by a religious studies teacher many years ago, and they thought it was such a fantastic study aid for the students studying religion and philosophy. And you see lots of comments on the YouTube link there with all of these students saying, hey, this film is amazing. I learned more from this film in 2 hours than all those books I learned, read last year, so it's 100 minutes long, but I think I'm so proud of that film because it stems from my father's question. And I think there's nothing I've ever seen address this question in such a kind of nuanced and honest way, and in a way that does not come up with patronizing simple answers.
Yeah. I look forward to watching it. And Mark, on another personal note, but a very important one, what inspired you to write the book Queer and Catholic, A Life of Contradiction? And what do you want your readers to get out of this book?
Well, it's basically when I realized that I was a gay man very early in my teens, I was blessed with an inner conviction that this wasn't particularly wrong or bad or unholy, because I was blessed with something at the age of 15. I fell very deeply, madly in love with a fellow school colleague. It wasn't a crush or a sexual obsession. It was the kind of love would have walked to the ends of the earth and given my life for somebody. And I wrote poetry and I became besotted, but I just knew that deep down that something as other regarding and wanting to put another person for myself was ultimately sacred and holy, and I thought this can't be in of itself wrong. So the irony was that when I went into religious life at the age of 21 years old, 22, I remember going for a walk in the parks in the university city of Oxford, and the man who was the vocations director for the Dominicans, he said, "We'd love to have you join the order, but do you have any that you want to say to us or tell us before you join us?" And I'd been encouraged to be very honest and very upfront about my sexual orientation with them, mm-hmm. so that they knew who they were taking on and there wouldn't be any problems. So very nervously, I took a deep breath and said, "Well, you know, I just want you to know that I'm." And then this man looked at me and smiled. He said, I think you'll find the word begins with G. And I said, "Oh, and does it rhyme with hay?" "Yeah, that's the one."
That's the one.
He was still smiling at me. And I said, is this okay then?" And then with this very, very accepting look on his face, he said, "Mark, I don't think you'll be the only one in the house."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And I discovered this irony, you know, that in the Catholic priesthood, there is a huge overrepresentation of gay men. And this is partly because of the way that gay men have been treated historically, that a lot of young men thought when they were attracted to other young men, I can't tell anybody about this. This must mean I must be meant to be a priest.
Hmm.
And that's a non sequitur. I mean, there really is no rhyme or reason to that. All it means is that you're attracted to other people of the same sex.
Yeah.
But what I knew, Richard, was that my parents, and that this book, please, listeners, once you've read Tsunami book, do get hold of Queer and Catholic. You'll have a lot more laughs with Queer and Catholic, I can tell you. it's full of great humor. I came out to my parents, Richard, at the age of 14. When my mother heard me talking in my sleep about this boy I'd fallen in love with.
Hmm.
She took me to the doctors to try and find medication to cure me.
Yeah, right.
And this was 1974 when everybody thought this was an illness.
Hmm.
And yet, you know, that beautiful, very, very devoted mother of mine in the last 5 years of her life came to gay Catholic conferences with me. She sat there with me. We went to Mass together, to church. We prayed together. And she said, "You know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with this. Every human being is called to love, to be loved. Everyone is made in the image of God. And there's nothing any more wrong with this than being left-handed or having blue eyes rather than brown eyes. It's the way God has made the world." And that's what Queer and Catholic is about. There is no choice to be made between your sexual orientation and your faith. The two are totally compatible.
I so agree with you. And, you know, considering the Catholic Church's view on homosexuality, also their view on celibacy, because, by the way, I was attending a very progressive Catholic church here in Indianapolis that had an amazing priest, Father Michael. He was the draw for me. But he shared with me early on that he might have to leave the priesthood because he didn't believe anymore on the Catholic Church's views on that. He eventually left the priesthood because he decided he wanted a family, and he wasn't allowed to do that. Do you think that will ever change in our lifetime, the Catholic Church's view on this?
Maybe not in our lifetime, but maybe that's because we're in advancing years. If we were having this conversation in our 20s, we might be able to say it will.
True.
I think a married priesthood will certainly come before women priests or any change in the teaching on homosexuality. But, you know, the irony here is that the Church formally, despite all of these nice changes of tone from Pope Francis, he has changed the mood music on this question, but it hasn't changed any of the formal teaching. You know, the 1986 letter from Cardinal Ratzinger sent to all of the cardinals and bishops of the world on homosexuality still describes this as an objectively disordered condition. Actually, there's a problem here for the Church. Many young people are scandalized by the way that the Church talks about LGBT people. I know lots of young people who say, I'm not going to church anymore if those people are going to be so bigoted. Yes. I've got gay and lesbian friends at school, and I'm not having them described in that way. And it's, goodness me, you know, can you imagine Jesus, the person who embraced the Samaritan and women and tax collectors and people who had all sorts of difficulties and illnesses, of which homosexuality, by the way, is not one, who just basically made a beeline for the marginalized at every single aspect of his life. Can you imagine Jesus using words like objectively disordered?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It really doesn't, stand scrutiny. I mean, the irony is that this Church, which teaches this, is staffed largely by gay men.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. If the Vegetarian Society found out half or more of its members secretly ate meat, it would have an identity crisis.
The hypocrisy is pretty thick.
It's so. I think either the Church has got this spectacularly wrong, which I think it has, or God has got an extraordinary sense of humor.
Yeah. Yeah, I think both. I would agree with both.
Yeah.
Well, this book we've been talking about, My Tsunami Journey, The Quest for God in a Broken World, is a book I highly recommend to all of you listening to this broadcast. The author is Mark Dowd, and Mark, it has been a delight to have you on this program. I so value your insights. You've blessed me by many of the things you've shared already. Now, if our people would like to learn more about the book and also reach out to you, what's the best way to do that?
Well, my delightful publisher, WIPF in Stock, based in Oregon, and the lovely Isabella Michon, who's been working as a publicist with me. Isabella said to me many months ago, Mark, you don't have a website. And I said, oh, that's true, I don't. She said, I'm sorry, but here in the U.S., any self-respecting author has to have a website, otherwise they don't really exist. So it's very simple. After the three W's, it's simply my name, Mark Dowd, markdowd.uk. And if you go to that website, you will see loads of information, not only about my tsunami journey, about the film that it's based on, but also there are links to dozens and dozens of the other documentaries and radio programs I've made. And there's a way of also corresponding by email. So if you do read the book and you have questions or thoughts, I'd be very, very keen to hear from you.
And those of us in the United States, thank you for that website, Mark. Thank you so much. I just am so impressed with the body of work you've done, your heart for humanity and this earth. And again, I encourage people to pick up a copy of My Tsunami Journey, The Quest for God in a Broken World. Mark Dowd, blessings on your day. Again, I want to thank Mark Dowd for being on the program. I encourage you to visit him online at markdowd.uk. Now, if you're listening here on WICR, a reminder that all shows are podcast on my website, richardbrendan.com. And for engineer Genesis Brown and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire, bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.